There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is June 24th, 2016, and this is episode 1815 of the Survival Podcast. It is a listener council show. That means it really is the show that's all about you, because you guys ask these questions of the council, with one exception. Today I have a little bit of an I told you so for a lead story today. I'm actually going to play audio for myself from the past, but not that far in the past, from Monday, because I have to tell you, then I got a litany of emails from you guys, not all of you, but from my audience, telling me I had crossed over into this conspiracy nut job world because of my take on the Orlando shooting. And I really was surprised by that, because I laid it out so logically. And the thing I got hit on the most was my assertion that the FBI was working Omar Bateen as an asset, basically using their assets to work him and to provoke him into striking out with terror so that they could entrap him, and that might have had something to do with everything. Turns out I was right. I'll tell you all about that. In fact, the article about me being right was actually out the day before I said it. I just hadn't read it yet. I'd speculated based on the information that I had available to me. So we'll talk about that. I'll also have a great piece from Mike and Sue Lepreys, because a listener just basically said, I've had it with government schools, and they yanked their kids. And when you hear why, you might have done it too, but now it's like, uh-oh, what do I do? I'm all of a sudden in the middle of this. How do I handle it? And then I have a dumb-ass question on solar hot water being answered by Stephen Harris. And Stephen Harris is going to be the Stephen Harris of old, the unreformed Stephen Harris that talks about how dumb someone is. But he has permission from the person who was dumb to talk about them being dumb. And he's one of my favorite people, by the way. The guy with the, well, Steve is too, but the guy with the dumb question. He has dumb questions once in a while. Sometimes his problem is not dumb questions, but too many questions at one time. We actually have what's called the Jake Rule at TSP Workshops, when Jake shows up anyway. And maybe we'll figure out why I have that today, too. I will also have a question from somebody who jacked up their knee. Gee, I know a little bit about that myself, but what their question is, this is like bad, I'm going to have surgery. What if I didn't have that option? What if the shit had hit the fan and I'm in a situation with a bad knee? Hey, Doc Bones, what will we do? Should it defend medicine, right? Then we have a question on the ins and outs of using waste fuel in a diesel engine. Kind of an update from Tim Glantz at Old Grouts Military Surplus. He was on the show a long time ago, all the way back in the 700s, talking about how he uses waste oil in his diesel truck. But it said I hadn't quite figured out like the best ratios and all yet, so listener asked for an update on that. Tim has a great update on that. And then Doc Bones, once again, we have a twofer from Doc Bones today. Fish antibiotics, especially amoxicillin, something that we've talked about in the past, but you can basically store amoxicillin for shit hit the fan by buying fish antibiotics. And yes, they are the exact same antibiotics that would be prescribed to you if your doctor prescribed them. Made in the same facility, made in the same capsule. They come in a different bottle with a fish on it, that's all. And same dosage, everything, but some people are allergic to penicillin, and that means you probably shouldn't be taking amoxicillin, because pretty much the same thing. So are there other options? Doc Bones talks about that. And a twofer, you say? How about two twofers? Twofer from Stephen Harris as he bats cleanup today. Testing your battery bank and your preps before you need them. And then I'm going to not play it, but I'm going to give you guys a throwback to episode 3. And you'll realize that Stephen Harris and I must think an awful lot alike. While it was a different angle that I came out, and I'll talk about it when we have Stephen speak, we didn't know each other's name yet, and boy, do we kind of go at this the exact same way. And then I have a song I've been waiting a long time to play for you as a cleanup song the closing song for today. All of that and more in just a bit. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our two sponsors of the day. Hey, folks, when I started TSP over 8 years ago now, the first company to ever offer to sponsor the show was Safecastle. And they've remained a loyal sponsor ever since February of 2009. And did you know they give away a lifetime discount membership to all MSB members? They do. And that can save you big money on everything you can imagine for your prepping needs. And with Safecastle, I do mean everything. Check out safecastle.com today to learn more. You know, I use a Berkey water filter in my home, and I have for over 6 years now. It's important to me to have the best quality water, but it's also important for me to get great service, pricing, and support, which is why I only deal with one source. That's Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason, one of the top dealers of Berkey in the world with customer service that will blow you away. Learn more at directive21.com. Again, directive, and then the number is 21.com. And with that, the history segment, we have road building becomes cheaper, quicker, and better. We have Napoleon's Waterloo, and we have the Bloody Battle of New Orleans and the Federalist Waterloo. This is all for the year 1815 because the episode is 1815. I am going to read the Bloody Battle of New Orleans and the Federalist Waterloo, as I kind of said I wanted to talk about yesterday, and Alex heard me, obviously. He was going to cover this anyway, but he kind of mentions in his piece, you'll hear it there. It is nearing the end of the War of 1812. Andrew Jackson is a major general in his state's militia. His men call him Old Hickory because he's tough like hickory. When the Indians go on a murder spree, holding children by the legs and beating their heads in, Jackson brings justice to them harsh and swift. Like most Americans, he believes that the Spanish and the British are arming the Indians, so he threatens the Spanish forces at Pensacola, takes their fort. He moves to New Orleans. The British land a force there, but wait for reinforcements. On December 23, 1814, Jackson's forces attack. Although the British beat him back, it forces them to rethink their strategy. They delay. That Christmas Eve, the Treaty of Ghent is signed. The War of 1812 is over. But out on the frontier, neither side realizes it. On January 1, 1815, the British attack. Jackson's eastern line fails, but the British have run out of ammunition, so they retreat. During the night of January 7th, 780 British troops cross the Mississippi to create a diversion the next morning, but they get bogged down in the mud. The main British force makes a frontal assault under the cover of darkness in heavy fog. As the sun rises, the fog lifts and they are exposed. It's a slaughter. It is embarrassing to say, but the British commander has forgotten to bring the ladders needed to scale the earthworks. Inside of 25 minutes, 700 British troops are killed, 1,400 are wounded, and 500 are taken prisoner. Only 13 Americans are killed. The British bugle boy who played through the battle actually lives. For the next several days, the British Navy bombards the fort at New Orleans and then departs. The Battle of New Orleans is over, but it never had to be fought. My take by Alex Shrugged. Once again, when telegraph lines are finally laid, unnecessary battles will not be fought. It seems like a side note, but the Federalists met at the same time in Hartford, Connecticut. They were discussing their ongoing complaints. Treason is probably too strong a word, but it was perceived as such by the public. With Jackson's win, the Federalists all looked like fools. They were done. Please note that Andrew Jackson had many admirable qualities, but one can legitimately criticize him severely on many points. He was a volatile man. For example, suggesting that the government should put his picture on the federal note would earn that person a bullet in the head. I don't think I'm exaggerating here. And one more thing. I had the Battle of New Orleans on the list of things to talk about, but all suggestions are welcome. I am weak on the 19th century, and I can use all the help I can get. You won't hurt my feelings, I promise. So if you have certain events that you really want covered through the 1800s, let Alex Shrugged know in the comments of any individual episode. Like, do it in the episode before the episode. Got it? So like, if it's like 1820, you might want to do it like 1815, 1816, like now. But Alex does check the comments, so I think it would be a great way. He hasn't told me it's okay to give you his email address, so I'm not going to do that unless he hears me today and says that's okay. But yeah, I mean, if you guys have certain things you want Alex to talk about, I'm sure he would love the input. My take on this is I wonder how many wars and battles that were fought were unnecessary and yet had dramatic consequences to the positive and the negative after they were. Andrew Jackson was cemented into hero status with this victory, even though it was unnecessary. It pretty much guaranteed that he would become a president of our country later on. And my admiration for Jackson is multifaceted. And I find it interesting a lot of times, you know, Alex mentions the guy was flawed and there was a lot of things that you can criticize. I never said there wasn't. Most people, there's things you can criticize and things you can admire. And I don't admire Jackson as a saint. I admire admirable things about him. One was his toughness. And I think that I wish that things had gone differently when settlers came to the New World with our relationships with the Native Americans. but don't think that, like, all of the woo-woo crap about Native peoples was true and there was no savagery on either side. There was savagery on both sides. And different groups were different in how they interacted with white settlers. And if you have a situation where you have people on the other side smashing children's brains in, responding with force, I just got to say, you know, someone's got to do it. He was tough, and he was willing to be tough, and he was also willing to destroy the National Bank. And if we had just kept things the way they were after he was gone, we would not be under the tyranny of the Federal Reserve today. And that's why when people say, well, Jack, what president did you like? What's the last president you think did a good job? I'm like, well, I kind of liked Eisenhower for certain things, but not really overall the presidency that he had. But I would say Andrew Jackson. And people think that's a pretty harsh thing to say, but there's a reason. And so I wanted to hear about the Battle of New Orleans today. And with that, let's go ahead and get to your first call. This call is for... No, we're not going to do your first call. I'm sorry. Yeah, I want to talk about this whole thing that I'm a conspiracy loon because I said, well, I'm going to just play what I said. So this is from Monday, and this is a small piece of it, about 5 minutes, and this is my take on what I think happened with Omar Bateen in Florida and why the FBI supposedly dropped its investigation when there were so many alarm bells going off. And why it may have actually come down the way that it did. So here you go. Listen to that, and I'll come back and read an article to you that I think might hit you between the eyes like a 2x4 if you're one of those people that sent me those emails saying I was nuts. I'm going to tell you what I think happened here. And I don't think it's what the extreme conspiracy people are saying, and I don't think it's the people that are just going, well, it just happened, and it just is what it is, and it looks like what it is, and mistakes were made, but that's I don't think so. So the official narrative is that this guy was interviewed multiple times by the FBI. He is the son of an Afghan immigrant who has an internet TV show that's pro-Taliban. That his father has been involved with the government multiple times. This guy's employed by GS4, a security organization used by government for different important things all over the country, all over the world, where he has to have background checks and shit like that. The co-workers in that organization said, this guy's, you know, they raised the red flag. They saw something, they said something. This guy's, there's something wrong with him, right? His ex-wife says he used to beat me and shit, and he's a radical. And the FBI investigates him and says, oh, he had a kid, and he's got a family now, it's okay. And they just go away. Well, here's one thing we do know, and I don't have links to all this because I read a bunch about this over the last week, everywhere I could find it, everything that seemed credible, and even things that didn't seem credible, to get all the sides of the story. But we know from FBI-released records that not only was he interviewed by agents who said, I'm here from the FBI and I'd like to talk to you about this, he was approached by what you call FBI assets. These are people who pose as being something else other than an FBI agent, a friend, a sympathizer, whatever. And they've used people like this, these assets in the past, to instigate people to do attacks. This was done successfully here in Dallas, Texas, where a Islamic male was convinced that he was talking to real people who were sympathetic to him wanting to blow up the I Am Pay building in downtown Dallas. They gave him real explosives with inert detonators and a cell phone that he could use to trigger it. And they encouraged him to go ahead with his plan. When he made the cell phone call that was supposed to detonate the bomb, he signaled to law enforcement that he did it, and they came in and they grabbed him. So we know they do that. We also know they screw shit up like this. And all I have to say, unless you're close-minded to that, is Fast and Furious. That they run sting operations, and things get out of hand and get out of control. Okay, so we have a guy, because here's why I don't believe the whole, we just decided it wasn't really, there wasn't enough, and there wasn't really any reason to continue the investigation, and we just kind of let it go, oops, it was a mess, oops, right, okay. Ted Kennedy was on the frickin' no-fly list. Ted Kennedy! Senator Ted Kennedy ended up on the no-fly list. This guy gets multiple investigations by the FBI. Okay? He's approached by undercover assets. We know both of those are true. And, gee, we just didn't think to put him on the watch list or the no-fly list. Even though all of the we got to have, we got to put people on a no fly list, no watch list, should not be able to buy a gun. They should not. It's just wrong. So I think he had handlers that either instigated it and made it happen, least likely. Right? I'm not going to put that and say my government wouldn't do that. And I'll tell you why you shouldn't believe that in a minute. Concrete evidence of why you shouldn't believe that they wouldn't do it. Or more likely, they were working him. They lost control of him. They thought he wasn't operational yet. Or they got diverted to another investigation. His shadows lost him in this. Didn't think he was ready to go through with it yet, and then he did. And I'll tell you why I think that's what happened. Or they made it happen. One or the other. We had way too much information, way too fast about this shooting. Way too much. Absolutely way too much. They knew everything, and not they, the media had every detail before the smoke was cleared. When I got up on Sunday morning, they knew everything. And they'd been reporting everything for longer. They knew everything about the ex-wife, about the current wife, about everything they knew. About the only thing they got wrong is they kept calling the gun an AR-15 when it actually isn't an AR-15. Other than that, it was almost like, I'm just saying, it was almost like they had a whole press kit ready to go. Way too much, not that the government knew it, that it was disseminated through the media way too quickly. As though there was some foreknowledge of something. And I would like to believe that when my government does shit like this to their own end, that they generally are trying to run a sting or something. They don't want to let the guy get away. But I believe it happens. I believe it might have happened in Sandy Hook, where we have radio of the police saying they have other people in custody. We have one point where you hear on the radio, I've got them spread eagle on the ground. We have children from Sandy Hook that said when they went to the fire station, they had two guys in handcuffs. Okay, so I came to that conclusion, as I said I did, because I had read reports that the FBI had simply admitted that they had assets who had approached Bateen. They did not specifically say what those people had done. They just simply said that they had undercovers who posing as non-agents approach him. And based on my knowledge of recent history, the things that went on here in Dallas, Texas, with the guy that they caught trying to blow up the IMPA building, etc., and observing what happened at Sandy Hook with the individuals who were arrested, and nothing was ever said about them ever again. It wasn't even like, oh, we apprehended a couple people by accident, and we didn't really mean to, and to protect them from, you know, unwarranted accusations, we're choosing to keep them anonymous or something like that. Just like, oh, it never happened. Okay, well, we have... So, like, with all of that, I came to the conclusion, a speculation, that they were working him. Okay. This article was actually written on the 19th. Here it is. Before Omar Mateen committed mass murder, the FBI tried to lure him into a terror plot. Yep. Before Omar Mateen gunned down 49 patrons at the LGBTQ Pulse nightclub in Orlando, the FBI attempted to induce his participation into a terror plot. Sheriff Ken McCara of Florida State Lucie County told the Vero Beach Press Journal that after Mateen threatened a courthouse deputy in 2013 by claiming he could order Al-Qaeda operatives to kill his family, the FBI dispatched an informant to lure Omar into some kind of act, and Omar did not bite. While the self-styled terror experts and former counterterrorism officials have criticized the FBI for failing to stop Mateen before he committed a massacre, the new revelation raises the question of whether the FBI played a role in pushing Mateen toward the act of lethal violence. Since 9/11, the FBI has relied heavily on informants to attract scores of young, often mentally troubled Muslim men and send them to prison for as long as 25 years. As Avasal reported for Alternet's Gray Zone Project, the FBI recently encouraged an apparently many literally disturbed recent convert to Islam named James Medina to bomb South Florida synagogue and pledge allegiance to ISIS, a militant group which he had no prior affiliation. On trial for planning to commit act of terror with weapons of mass destruction, Medina has insisted through his lawyer that he's mentally ill. I would think if you're trying to blow people up, you're mentally ill, by the way. Trevor Arison, a journalist and author of Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror, revealed that nearly half the terror cases between 9/11, 01, and 2010 involved informants, including some with criminal backgrounds, raking in as much as $100,000 from the FBI. The FBI assets have often preyed on mentally ill men with little capacity to resist their provocations. Is it possible the FBI is creating a new enemy we fear? Arison wondered. You can read the rest of this article you want if you want yourself. Okay, I have a couple things to say. Number one is I told you so, and I want you to understand that the FBI didn't come out and say this. This sheriff came out and said this. Okay, which means was this the only attempt? Likely not. Likely not. I also want to point out something that you could gloss over if you don't pay attention. Mateen told a courthouse deputy that he could order Al-Qaeda operatives to kill his family. That alone is terroristic threat. There's enough there, if you can prove that it happened, to issue a charge. Maybe not something, put something away for 20 years, but you could certainly at least go after the person for issuing terroristic threats to a law enforcement officer. If I went up to a random police officer on the street and said, you know what, man, I don't like what you're doing, and I think I could get somebody to kill your family, I just bet you, that I'm going to go spend a little bit of time in jail. A little bit of time. Okay, this brings a whole new level of stink to something that already stunk really bad. The three-day fish thing for Benjamin Franklin has nothing on the stink on this now. This man threatened to have the family of a court deputy killed, and he was able to keep his job at G4S. He was able to keep his clearances. He was worked by the FBI as a potential terror suspect, but never ended up on the terror watch list or the no-fly list. And oops, I'm back to oops. Okay, I just want to say, when you get factual revelations like this, it's no longer conspiracy theory. If anything, it's conspiracy fact. Or in this case, it's just simply fact. The FBI does this. And you think it's not possible that exactly what I said happened now happened, that they were working the guy, and the people that are working them, some of them are just criminals and thugs, and CIs, confidential informants, etc., and they don't really give that much of a shit. So all of a sudden, he just goes kind of haywire, goes loose, and pops early. I'm just saying. How could someone, under this much scrutiny, with this much history, not be on a terror watch list, not be on a no-fly list when Senator Ted Kennedy ended up on the no-fly list? You know what you are, if you believe the official story at this point? You're a coincidence theorist. Don't call me a conspiracy theorist. I'm just someone digging into the facts going, something's not right here. Something's not right here. The only way you could explain all of the stink around these things is to believe in an innumerable number of accidental coincidences and oops. I don't. I'm sorry. So let's go to something better. So I have a question here. First one of the day for an expert council member. A couple parents get really sideways with the local school district and say, you know, we just had about enough of you people. We're done now. We won't be dealing with you anymore. You'll hear why from Mike and Sue. And we're done. And our kid is out of your clutches. Bye-bye. Now go away. Good for you. Awesome. But now they're like, holy crap. What do? We weren't really prepared for this. We just reached our limit with the state. Now we have to actually take this responsibility on. How do we get started? Mike and Sue, take it away.
Hi, Jack and the TSP community. This is Michael and Sue LaPrise with HaloBySue.com, designing the life you'd love to live. For the expert council, today our question comes from Brian in Oregon. Brian says, here in Oregon, the school board threatened us with an, hold your breath for this one, $850 fine for our child missing 15 days of school because the school demands people send their kids regardless of how sick they are, and we refuse to. After a meeting with the school principal, where she way overstepped her bounds, we removed our six-year first-grade daughter from their ravenous clutches. The problem is we simply don't know where to get quality material to provide her with the best unindoctrinated education possible. Your expertise is greatly appreciated. Well, Brian, I hope we can give you some help today in choosing your own style of unindoctrination. While doctrina in the original Latin simply was a word for teach, today we generally know the term indoctrination in a religious environment that doesn't allow for questions or criticism of those beliefs.
And the institutional education complex that we have allowed bureaucrats to build up today feels very much like a Nazi-style indoctrination where mandatory temporary incarceration of all children is required in order to ensure the state's agenda. We're always very thankful for those parents who wake up to freedom and figure a way out of that matrix. We know it's not easy, but we'd like you to consider what we have for you today and at least make an attempt at home-based learning while school is out for the summer. Remember that you should check with HSLDA, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, for details on your state's requirements. Each state has their own unique set of rules for self-education of minors. For example, Oregon doesn't require you to start school until a child is 7 years old after September 1st. The first step to trying home education is just not sending your kids until you have to.
Oregon also requires regular testing of students, but you don't have to use the state tests. There are actually better tests that don't change as often with the political tides of your state's education agency and politicians. We'd recommend either the Iowa test first used in 1935 or the Stanford Achievement Test that began in 1926. Since testing a child should be more about finding out their progress and not a teacher's salary, you can have these tests administered each year for a small fee.
Brian has decided to remove his kiddo from the wait for me to tell you what to do government school and is stepping out into some very scary freedom. It's really different to choose freedom for yourself versus the children you're responsible for. Remember, you can find more information on our website, halobysue.com, or ask for more specific help there. Start with real life in your home-based learning adventure. You're not doing school anymore. You're learning with your children. We recommend that families begin by setting up a house plan that includes time for waking up and sleeping, a chore system for both self-care and participation in the household chores at the appropriate level. Then you'll need to figure out a week, month, and year plan that works for your family. We've tried over the years to pull away from the government school calendar, but found that all our church and even homeschool activities revolved around that. It has been so frustrating.
Our base support group has three families who are all Spurkowites. We plan around the seasons in the garden for school and fellowship. We freed our time and calendar up to really enjoy family holidays and plan all of our camping and vacations whenever government school is locked down with its captives. For me, it's also easy to get time off at work when no one else wants off. You have to decide what works for you and your family. It's really important that you design daily and weekly quality activities for learning into your life. This is going to fluctuate as your kids get older or you add more kids to your design. Here is one math example. Right now we're using cash for budgeting so that we end up with lots of loose change. And we put all this in a jar, and after the chores, the kids get 25 cents. The 3 and 4-year-olds get 1/4, and since they don't actually understand the value of the money, sometimes they take a penny or a nickel. Our 8 and 9-year-olds each get 25 cents, but they can't have a quarter and have to count out the 25 cents each day. Each day there is different change, so they have to think about it every time. This is a great daily activity that doesn't require a worksheet or any work on Sue's part. It's a plan in the design that just keeps running.
We also have a cash register with real money. When we go shopping, the kids bring the receipts home and play with them. Right now, the 8 and 9-year-old just count out the money for each price on the list, and sometimes they use it as an adding machine for various numbers. We follow a sort of Montessori approach to learning, so finding math activities and things for about 10-year-olds is easy if you have a concept you want to teach your child. Then we have boxes for various math concepts like measuring, sorting, basic number concepts, counting bears, and some Montessori tools. The main thing to think about when doing activities rather than worksheets is the conversation you're having while doing these things. You have to learn to listen and ask really good questions.
What questions do you ask while learning? Do you need them written down in script from a curriculum guide? Absolutely not. But you may want to type these questions up and post them around your house to remind yourself that you're raising a thinker. So instead of telling them things, you're going to start asking them questions. Are you ready for how easy this is? What, why, where, when, how? If you actually post this around your house and start asking more questions rather than you instructing, you'll find that the thinking in your house will go through the roof. Be patient when you ask a question. In the past, I was in a hurry for the answers, so I didn't give them enough time to answer the questions themselves. Remember, them answering questions is part of the learning process. It's like a doctoral program for all ages.
All the curriculum guides and teachers' materials, which are very expensive and super time-consuming to learn how to use and read through, all boil down to this: who, what, why, where, when, how. It took me 3 years of co-op to realize that if I wanted to hear what the 12 to 18-year-old students had to say in any subject, the less I read the teacher guide and the more I asked these basic questions, the more interested and engaged the students are. The same goes for science. You don't need a curriculum up until about age 12 in any form. You need to do interesting things with your kids, then ask and answer questions pertaining to that. And I can hear people right now thinking, but I don't know all the answers. No kidding. No one does. Even the person most versed in a topic can find something new. So become a learner of new things with your child. The technology is there to learn about diaper rash, long division, and string theory. You have on hand in your house a series of science topics that you might not think about because they aren't in the curriculum. Start learning more about your pets, the garden, food, electricity, or water. Then try what's nearby, the zoo or nature center, the beach or the mountains, the desert. It's there, so use it.
For reading, just start reading to your kids regularly. Most libraries allow families that home educate the option for checking out longer than 2 weeks, so you don't have to go as often and you can consume way more books, including audiobooks or the new apps like Ocean House Media that has Read Aloud, Read Along, or Read to Me books. Leaders aren't readers. Leaders are thinkers. So be sure not to sell your kids short if they struggle with reading at any point. Readers aren't better spellers or writers, so don't link this to your success or failure as a teaching parent. Reading is about gathering ideas and concepts into your kids, so choose wisely and have lots of conversations along the way. When I first started reading aloud to our kids 25 years ago, I thought everyone had to sit still and be quiet. Sue would give me the book and explain. 6-year-old Eric wants to help you read all the words he knows in the book. 3-year-old Jessica wants to color noisily, but don't worry, she can hear everything you're reading. Eric and Jessica will ask lots of questions. It's more important to answer the questions as you go along than to get to the end of the book. And 1-year-old Rhea wants to sit on your lap and help turn the pages. I'm really good at this now, but the first years it was difficult to suppress the desire to control everyone and have them sit still and quiet while I did the job of finishing the story. History can call into reading, writing, and science local, state, or even current events. No program is needed for younger kids, and even an older child can plan their own course of study. And of course, there's always Alex Shrugged. We totally love this TSP moment each day.
Most of our literature now comes out of what we're doing, and since I've been doing this a long time and love children's books, my head is full of what books go with what activities, and even when I'm only close to the connection, either the great Google machine or the librarian can help me complete the connection. Every few Fridays, we stop at the produce market and get a box full of anything under $10 to process, and then our next stop after that is the library. One day, we bought 3 flats of blueberries, and then we picked up the story, Blueberries for Sal, and we made blueberry syrup. Like the mom in the book, the next morning, we had it on pancakes. It's not just about that one story, but about connecting the story to your life to make it memorable. I've bought reading and phonics curriculums over the years and always regret the cost. I love cutting and gathering all the materials, but very quickly we begin to lose pieces, which makes the program less and less fun. What we do use are flashcards with words the kids are learning, and along with that, we learn phonics rules.
Let's move on to the actual materials. Sue has the curriculum we use listed on the website, but we'll give you a rundown on what to look for when home educating. Mainly, we try to use materials designed by homeschoolers who have large families, who also like to learn in community. Curriculum designers with large families create materials that is easy to share with more than one child at no additional cost. The recommended resources they suggest you gather are good for multiple levels, disciplines, and activities. They develop the parent materials for parents and not classroom teachers, and there tends to be a lot of conversation built in to allow for a wide array of adjusting the details while staying on course with the basic math, writing, science, or history topic. When you look at curriculum designed for a parent by a parent, it also is much easier to see how to develop something unique for your own child.
For example, we've used our Institute for Excellence in Writing program for 18 years, and I actually don't look at it anymore. I just create my own checklists and guidelines for each child as they progress. This is the beauty of picking and sticking with one curriculum. Every single time you buy a new curriculum, you have to relearn as the parent. We decided when we adopted 7 years ago that we weren't going to spend our time on that anymore and just adapt what we already had to our learning. Whether you love or hate history, I would recommend you find a great 4-year history cycle style curriculum that is based on the timeline of history. The earlier in your home learning career that you begin to use this, even if it's very slowly, the easier it will be as your child grows. These tend to be expensive, but you can begin your history journey with a simple paper timeline, some maps, and library books. And don't forget the non-traditional educational materials. Jack mentioned a while back the American Boys Handbook by Daniel Carter Beard, and you can find other interesting books by him from the early 1900s. There's a girls' version of this book, along with the Dangerous Book for Boys and the Daring Book for Girls that are super fun.
Here are some reminders as we wrap this up. You are your child's best teacher, and you can do a better job than the government minders. It's not about the curriculum, but learning to think about what you want to learn and how to go about it. A purchased curriculum isn't necessary unless the state mandates it. Be sure to begin with quality activities before adding quality materials. And we're here to help. Thanks again, Jack, and the TSP community for this chance to encourage people toward the freedom of educating their own children. This has been Michael and Sue LaPrise with HaloBySue.com for the Expert Council.
I just want to say I think Mike and Sue are a fantastic resource for this audience because I know more and more people are struggling with the concept of what government schools do to our children and what they're now doing to us as parents and what they're telling us we can't do. I personally, when I was a young man in my 20s, never thought I would live in a world where a parent would be told, we will fine you because you've made a decision for your child to not be in school. When I was in school, you know, if you didn't come to school and your parents were aware of it and they notified the school, that was the end of the discussion because, gee, parents are responsible for their children. You know, as long as it wasn't like you're gone for a month or something like that. But, you know, if you're out for your sick for a week, two, whatever it was because you were actually sick, or because they wanted to take you on a vacation and thought you could be excused and said, we'll take his work in advance and we'll make sure it gets done, it was never a problem. If you think it's okay for our schools to be doing what they're doing now, I know I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist yet again, but the fluoride in your water is working on your brain. And I don't know that that's the purpose of it, but that's the results of it, and the programming on the TV is working on your brain. This is not okay. I don't know how we've become such a passive bunch of wusses in this country that we will let a school district tell us what we can and cannot do with our own children. They are not public schools. They are government schools. Do you get it yet? I hope so. On to some amusement. As I said, we have Stephen Harris answering a stupid question. Steve's words. With permission from Jake. So, Jake, you have it coming, because if you tell Steve he's allowed to do something like this, well, it just might happen. And I think we'll all learn something, too, beyond just don't tell Stephen Harris it's okay to make you look like a dumbass on TSP, because he'll probably do it.
Hi, this is Steve Harris. I'm calling in to answer your question. Stay with me. You're going to remember this one. I have a dumbass question from a dumbass listener. And his name is Jake Robinson. And this is about where Jack is probably busting the gut listening to this. Jake did some absolutely stupid things and screwed up a whole bunch of my stuff. And I called him on it. He goes, I'm sorry, Steve. I didn't mean to do that. But I got this question for you, and you can go on TSP and call me a dumbass listener. And I said, Jake, I'll do that. He goes, why do I think I believe you? Well, Jake, I'm doing it. Jake is not only a friend, Jake is a very good friend. I told him, next time you have a question like that, call me on my cell phone, buddy. So I just had to give you a little grief. Jake's question is on solar hot water heating. And I won't read the whole question because it just comes down to, do I want solar hot water heating or not? Solar hot water heating basically sucks. Why? Not because solar hot water heating doesn't work. It's because hot water in general, hot water in your house, is not a huge energy user. If you had a 50-gallon hot water tank, you wanted to heat it from 60 degrees Fahrenheit out of the ground to 140 degrees Fahrenheit for bathing, which is cooled down with cold water, that's going to use just over 30,000 BTUs of energy. If you had a 100,000 BTU furnace, that's the same energy, that amount of energy to heat that water is the same amount of energy as your furnace running for 20 minutes. And how many hours a day does your furnace run in the wintertime? So the amount of energy using for making hot water is small compared to the huge amount of energy your furnace is going to use. Now, heating this amount of hot water from 60 to 40 in a 50-gallon tank might cost about 25 cents in natural gas. Yes, I did the calculation. This could be around 50 cents for propane. So if you use two 50-gallon tanks of hot water a day, per day, on average, then you're looking at about $30 a month in propane bill for hot water, and about half that, $15, for natural gas. The return on investment to install $1,000 or $2,000 for the solar hot water heating is just not there. Especially putting up evacuated solar tubes, it's just not economically feasible. Now, what I said is awesome is solar hot air. Every BTU of hot air that you make saves you on BTUs that your furnace has to run. Solar hot air heaters have to be built on location. They can't be made and shipped easily. They're big. Solar hot water heaters can be made and shipped because they're smaller. That is why, and the only reason why, you see solar hot water heaters for sale and not solar hot air heaters for sale on the open market. Now, solar hot water does work nicely if you have an off-grid or bug-out location where you do not have natural gas or propane or electricity for hot water. It's as simple as an old door on the ground, some 2x4s or 2x10s for a frame, and some glass from a sliding glass door. You fill it with water, let the sun heat it up, use an on-demand RV pump, water pump to move the water at pressure into your dwelling, and you have hot water. This is detailed in my book, along with solar hot air heaters, Sunshine $2, that you can get at knowledgepublications.com. Now, if you were in socialist California, where electricity can be 35 cents a kilowatt hour, when the rest of the country is at 8 to 12 cents, then you might consider solar hot water heater if you had electric hot water in California and you could not get natural gas or propane. That same 50-gallon hot water tank at 35 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity would cost you $3.50 to heat it up once versus 15 cents for natural gas, $3.50 for heat in California. So what it comes down to is the same thing for solar electricity as is for solar water. It's not an issue of saving money. It's an issue of energy independence. If you want hot water heating energy independence to go along with your solar electricity energy independence, if this is much more expensive with a very long return on investment, then go ahead and buy it if that is what your dream is and that is what you would like to do. Speaking of advice, do you like my advice? Would you like my advice? I've been on the board of directors of the CAC Team Disaster Response Group for a few years, and it's taught me a lot about how to be a board member and what board members do and how they advise and direct the company. If you have a board of directors for your corporation and you'd like someone who tells it like it is, speaks plainly, has expertise in marketing, advertising, electrical engineering, power generation and usage, as well as chemistry, then I might just be your person. Go to stephenharris.net to contact me. I know I'll be able to help guide you to greater success. You can find all the stuff I did with Jack at steven1234.com. My contact information is also there. Thank you, guys. Hope I gave you a little entertainment. And thank you to Jake as well for your humor. And I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Overall, it actually wasn't that bad. He just kind of beat up on Jake. And that's a friendly thing there because they're friends and they're on that board together. Jake actually serves on that board for CAC Team as well. So anyway, I mostly agree with Steve there. I think that there are probably other situations where you're using electricity for hot water that electricity ends up taking up. You end up spending a lot of your electrical budget on hot water, depending on the size of your house, how much hot water you use, etc. However, when you look at, you know, 30 to 60 cents a day, $2,000 to $5,000 to install a professional system, it's a long, long, long ROI. And that assumes that you're getting 100% efficiency from your solar hot water system, which means, yeah, because see, what happens mostly with solar hot water, the way it works is you have a solar hot water array that dumps water into your actual water heater. You still have one, and then that hot water heater maintains that temperature, and as you empty it, new hot water's coming in. It doesn't have to raise the temperature. That's how it actually saves it. So that there's still an energy burn there, right? So I think it really depends. Like you said, California is the perfect example of where it probably makes the most sense. But for independence, it's the way to go, and it actually is pretty easy, and it does work pretty good. Next question is for Doc Bones on, well, jacking up a knee. Like I said, something I know about, and doing a really good job on it. Sounds like worse than I did. And, you know, now this guy's going to have surgery, and but he's wondering, well, what if that wasn't an option? So Doc Bones, take it away.
Hi, Joe Alden here, also known as Dr. Bones, author of the brand spanking new third edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. Close to 700 pages of information that will help you succeed, even if everything else fails. I'm also the founder of www.doomandbloom.net, where you'll find over 800 posts, podcasts, videos, all sorts of stuff on medical preparedness for any disaster. This week's question for the Survival Podcast Expert Council is from Justice William Kelly, who writes, what are your suggestions for torn MCL, ACL, meniscus, and other knee soft tissue joint injuries in an SHTF situation? Details and background. 40-year-old male, 6 feet, 240 pounds, 22% BMI, doesn't sound right. Large build and muscular structure, okay, due to logging, military, and heavy construction work. Injury occurred in late February while running 8-mile route on country road with full gear on. Wow, plate carrier, full pack weapon, 80 pounds typical. That is quite an accomplishment. He stepped off the main road surface into 4 inches deep rut with left leg fully extended, and when right foot landed short, the knee shifted front and inside, made a snapping sound, ouch, and immediately gave out, spinning me leftwards and on my butt. Initial exam was stressed medial collateral ligament, MCL, but was told to take some time off and use ice and elevate the extremity to allow to heal and see how things were. Fast forward to early May, used 3 tubes of comfrey ointment added to the ice at elevation. Things felt better. I tried a 6-mile walking ruck with basic gear and noticed the knee was really acting up by mile 4. Had an MRI done 3 days later. Major issue was complex compound menisci tear, plus evidence of moderate MCL tear or stress. Doc said my muscle mass hid much of the injury issues. I'm not sure if this is real. Doing surgery June 23rd to debride the meniscus and check the medial collateral ligament. That's all good in a grid-up situation, solid medical care surgery, but what about a, you know what, hits the fan situation and dealing with an injury like this? What are long-term effects both with or without treatments? Well, wow, Your Honor, tough questions and some tough answers going to come back at you here. Certainly, the survival medic's going to see a wide range of orthopedic injuries, some of which can be easily treated, and some others not so much. And the injuries can be complicated, as we see in the example that we just heard. And so let's define some terms for those who aren't sure of the anatomy. You have a number of fibrous bands of tissue that give strength and stability to joints called ligaments. You have several in your knee, four of them in total, and the medial collateral ligament, MCL, is located on the inside of your knee but outside of the joint, the knee joint itself. Ligaments like the MCL hold bones together and add stability and strength to a joint. In this case, the MCL connects the top of the shin bone, or tibia, to the bottom of the thigh bone, or femur. Now, an injury to the MCL can be mild or severe. It can be stretched, which is called a type 1. It could be partially torn, a type 2, or it could be completely snapped, a type 3. Now, the symptoms of an MCL injury include a popping sound or a snap, pain and tenderness along the inner part of your knee, the knee swells, a feeling that your knee is going to give out when you put weight on it, and indeed it might, locking or catching in the joint. Problems with knee stability, if you're really having trouble moving things around and the joint is not stable and there are certain maneuvers you can do to identify this, that usually indicates a grade 2 or a grade 3 injury. Now, a meniscus tear, which you have also, or menisci tear, which means both of your meniscuses are injured, that's another kind of problem altogether, and it does involve the knee joint. The menisci of the knee are two pads of fibrocartilaginous tissue that serve as shock absorbers, and they disperse friction in the knee joint between the lower leg and the thigh. Indeed, they bear essentially your entire weight when you're standing or and are constantly under stress. You've got two menisci in each knee, and the medial menisci is the most often injured. Probably you have that one injured. There are several different types of menisci tears, and you probably have a couple of different types of tears. That's why they're calling it complex. Symptoms of a torn meniscus include knee pain, swelling, popping, and giving way. Now, when the meniscus is damaged, there's irritation that occurs, and the surface that allows the bones to glide over each other smoothly in the knee joint, that's no longer smooth, and pain can occur with each flexion and extension every time you do that with your knee. Now, the first steps of treatment after the acute injury usually include rest, ice, compression, and elevation. That's R-I-C-E, RICE. You obviously did that. Anti-inflammatory medications like ibuprofen or naproxen may help relieve pain and inflammation. Ice packs, certainly, or some other way to get cold to the area, especially in the early going, will help decrease inflammation and swelling. Weight bearing has to be limited for a period of time, and that time is dependent on the severity of the injury. So crutches, probably useful. Knee braces may be helpful, but not all physicians agree with that. We'll talk about that in a minute. Weight is an issue as well. Controlling weight will decrease the amount of work the knee has to do. Exercise, usually using stationary bicycles, is helpful. Braces are used in some cases where activity must be performed. Speed and completeness of recovery in total with knee injuries depends on how good the blood supply is to the area. But once damaged, it's never, at least in my opinion, good as new. Knee braces might be helpful to give the feeling of support to an unstable knee. Maybe people feel better when they have one on. Some orthopedic surgeons, though, aren't so certain as to their ability to stop further injury. Others will recommend them in the hopes that less strain will occur to the injured ligaments. Now, issues I see in a long-term survival setting would be the difficulty in determining the extent of these injuries. MRIs and other high-tech studies are done to identify how bad things are, so you might not know exactly where you stand, pun intended in that one. Indeed, being heavily muscled could actually make it more difficult to make a diagnosis. Low-level injuries are going to heal just with rest and working with a little physical therapy to make sure you work the range of motion. More severe injuries just might not return to full function without surgical intervention. You should give your patient with a knee injury a lot of rest, support, physical therapy to improve strength and range of motion. Now, this is not the easiest thing to accomplish in a true survival setting. If fast movement's required, you're not going to get it out of somebody recovering from these types of injury. The important thing is to have ice packs, even the shake and break kind, ACE wraps, ibuprofen, Comfrey Savlace, crutches, splints, tapes, and yes, knee braces. The lesser injuries will probably experience a full recovery. The major injuries probably won't, and there may always be some stiffness or other issues with the knee. We have to be realistic about what it means to return to an earlier era if the grid goes down for good in the uncertain future. My recommendation is to use technology while you have it. If you do have problems with your knee now, get those problems fixed. And if you get those problems fixed, your knee will be in the best shape possible to deal with the rigors of daily living in a survival scenario. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health and good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Oh, hey, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Prepper Show and on Facebook at Doom and Bloom. Plus, check out our new third edition Survival Medicine Handbook at Amazon.com. Make sure you get the 2016 third edition. Lastly, Nurse Amy has her entire line of medical kits on display for you to see at store.doomandbloom.net. That's store.doomandbloom.net. Use Jack's special code for a 10% discount. Thanks again.
I'll throw a little in there based on my experience with actually experiencing an injury that was quite incapacitating for the first week, definitely. I think there's times when, you know, surgical correction is what you should do, and considering that is worth doing. I wish I could find the study now, but I recently, or not recently, a few months ago when I was dealing with this and making a decision, what am I going to do, read a study that said that in many instances, physical therapy has been shown to be just as effective in full restoration as surgical intervention. And I believe that any time we open the body up, we go inside, we start cutting things, we have the potential to make them better, and we have the potential to make them worse. And there's always a risk associated with surgery. So I think you have to make the determination for yourself based on the situation. I wouldn't say just because you have any problem with a joint or anything to go get surgery on it because, well, the grid might go down and then you won't have it as an option. I don't make decisions that way. So Doc is a doc and he's a surgeon. Right, so he's a lot more comfortable with that than I am because that's his world. I'm a bit skeptical. I've never claimed not to be, and Doc and I have had some pretty interesting discussions about that. So just my opinion there. I also, though, say from personal experience, the concept of crutches, braces, etc. on hand, absolutely, because you could have a short-term grid down situation, and just being immobile is a nightmare. It is absolutely a nightmare. And there's two places that we can hurt ourselves to do maximum incapacitation. And one is the knee, and the other is the neck back area. Both of those have the potential because they bear so much supporting weight of our bodies. And it's where we have to be careful, and I've kind of made a commitment to myself to be more careful about extending myself as, you know, I accept the fact that I'm not 20 years old anymore. When I was 20 years old, I swear I could have fallen off a cliff, you know, and like 3 days later, be like, yeah, I took some Motrin, dude. I'm good, right? I mean, you just seem like you heal so quickly and so rapidly when you're young. I'll also say that if there comes an opportunity in your life to acquire cheaply a wheelchair, it may be worth doing. Here's how it happened for us. It was a necessity that turned into a wheelchair. We haven't actually used it for anything yet, although I did play with it to see what the dog thought. It was pretty funny to watch Max as I chased him with a wheelchair through the house. But my father-in-law is in a memory care Alzheimer's type facility, has to be. Just, I mean, love the man, but he's plumb nuts at this point. And he has good days where he can walk and use a walker. He has good days where he can walk without anything, though they don't want him to do that because he can become unsteady at some point. And then there's days he really is better off having a wheelchair. Sometimes he uses the wheelchair like a walker, but that way he can sit down when he needs to. And he was getting where he needed a wheelchair, and they were giving him one. And I'm thinking for, you know, what we pay for him to be in that place, if you need a wheelchair, get it. But it's really more like an apartment-type situation with caregivers. Like, try to give them all the freedom they can and what have you, and they do a wonderful job. If you ever need a facility like this, look for Silverado, see if they're in your area. Blown away by how they take care of them. But I got to where I'm like, well, this whole, like, they have a wheelchair for him, but then it has to go to this person because he doesn't need it, now he needs it again. Just, you know, you can get a wheelchair for $150 on Amazon. So we ordered one, had it delivered there, they put it together, they gave it to him. It also turned out that Medicare would pay for like a custom wheelchair for him. But it took like 2 months for him to get it, which is great. If you need a wheelchair, then it takes 2 months. So they come in and they measure him and everything. They custom build this wheelchair. And if we had to buy it, this would have been like a $1,500 wheelchair. So he gets the wheelchair, and now we have the other wheelchair. And my first inclination was, well, just leave it there. But then my thought was, well, we paid for it, so we brought it home. And I can see that being incredibly valuable if you have a situation where you can't get somewhere or you need to get somewhere and you have someone that's been immobilized. So I'm not saying run out and buy a wheelchair tomorrow. I am saying that if you see one at like a sale or there's like a, some, you know, any kind of opportunity where you can get one inexpensively, it may really be worth doing. Let's go ahead and take another question. This one for Tim Glantz on waste oil and using it as fuel in diesel trucks.
Hey there, Jack, and all you TSP listeners. Tim Glantz here from Old Grouch's Military Surplus with an expert panel answer for Jim in Florida, who is asking about some stuff I talked about way back in episode 745 where I mentioned running waste motor oil as a fuel in a diesel vehicle. Now, you can't run straight 100% waste motor oil in most vehicles, and I had mentioned then that I was working on finding the right blend. And for my 6.2, 6.5 GMs and 7, 6.9, 7.3 Fords, here's what I found. I can run up to about a 60% waste motor oil, 40% diesel mixture without any trouble in the summer. If I can go up to 80% waste motor oil if I use some gasoline to thin it and get it down to a thin enough viscosity where it will pump through the pumps. That said, I noticed when I was running that much waste motor oil that I did get a varnish inside my injection pump, and I did get coking on the injectors, and I did end up, after running that for a long time in a 6.2 that I was just kind of testing the destruction, I did have to pull the injectors and clean them. Wasn't that big of a deal, but it's something to keep in mind. And the reason I tested it that far was I wanted to make sure that I knew how much I could do in an emergency. Now, day to day, I do still burn it. When I change my oil, it goes right in the fuel tank after I filter it. Filtering is very important. I'll talk about that. In the summer, though, I don't go higher than about 30-35% waste motor oil mixed with the diesel. In the winter, I keep it around 10-15%. And if the forecast is to take it anything below about 15 degrees, I don't do it at all. Because you will make your fuel gel up or thicken faster when you add this, because motor oil will thicken faster than diesel will. And in cold weather, that can cause hard starting and a whole host of other issues. The good thing about it is, even if you're only running 30-35%, you just literally cut your fuel bill by 30-35%. And you got rid of what otherwise is a hazardous waste to get rid of, and it's saving you money. Now, some tips for doing this. Number one, filter, filter, filter. You need to filter as well as you can before it ever goes in your tank, and you need to get any and all moisture out. It's critical. Water will kill your fuel system in a diesel. And it will be suspended in motor oil. Waste motor oil does have condensation in it. The way I do mine is it goes straight into a barrel, which then is painted black, and it actually sits in the sun. And the heat will help it separate. And then when I draw off that barrel, I've got a spigot put into the side of it about 8 inches up. So water is settled down on the bottom, and I draw from above it, and I draw slowly out of it. And that's my first step to getting the water out. The next thing I do is filter it. I've got a couple of different filter styles. There's a company close to me called Green to Gold Filters. I believe they're still around. And I've got one of their filters. Or the one I'm using right now is actually, it's a pretty neat setup. I just went to Lowe's and got three of those whole house water filter type setups that you put under your sink. Put them in a row. And I've got a 25 micron filter, a 10 micron filter, and a 4 micron filter in a row, and I gravity feed the waste motor oil through that. Now, typically, especially when it's not really hot, I will thin that with some diesel before I put it through because it'll flow through better. There's no harm in thinning it before, just keep an eye on it and know what ratio you thinned it to, so when you're finally putting it in, you get a good, you get the right ratio. You can pump it through. I prefer to gravity feed. I'm not in a hurry, and the less you disturb and have suction on that main thing, tank that you're pulling it out of, the slower it goes, the more your water and your big contaminants are going to settle down in the bottom of that. Once it's out of there, I let it settle again, and I inspect and make sure that there's no a lot of deposits down in there that, you know, are an indication my filtration failed. Then it goes into my tank. Now, I'm filtering down to 4 microns there, but the fuel filters on these vehicles are only a 10 micron filter. So I'm actually filtering to a greater degree than the fuel system was designed to need. That's it. Don't skimp on filtering and getting the water out of the fuel, because you're just going to cost yourself money instead of saving money when you destroy fuel system parts doing this. There are pre-made fuel systems out there. You can look on eBay, guys. I mean, not fuel systems, but filter systems. Guys are selling them. You can do those. There's all kinds of different ideas. Some people are using old water heaters and using the heating elements to heat it before it runs through. I'm not a huge fan of putting a lot of electricity near a bunch of waste motor oil, but some folks have had good luck with it. It seems to me if you're burning that much electricity, you're kind of killing some of the economic advantage, however. One thing I will say for you folks in colder climates, to assess how your blend can work in different temperatures, mix different ratios in small batches in little baby food jars and simply put them outside. And when the temperature's 30 degrees, go out and see at what ratio it's thickened up. When it's 20, you can see and all that stuff. And over the course of, you know, first half of the winter, when you've got different temperatures, you can actually assess and say, all right, you know, this kind of blend is where it starts to thicken, and actually learn how those fuel systems blends behave in the cold weather, because you can't actually see into your fuel tank with the stuff that's actually in your tank. That gives you a good visual representation. Hope that gives you some idea of how it all works and what I've been doing. It does work. It does save you some money. The last word of advice I will give is every state is different. Check with your state laws on fuel tax and what it takes to legally burn an alternative fuel. Some states have said, hey, if you're burning this stuff, we're going to exempt you from these fuel tax registration and all this other stuff. Some have not, and if they catch you putting waste motor oil in your tank without whatever permits they're requiring, they are going to run you up a big fine. And fine you for the road use tax, and then when they're done, they're going to send you over to the IRS and claim you're a fuel tax violator, and the IRS will come after you for the federal share. And that is a mess you don't want to get into, so make sure you check if you're going to run these on the highway, and make sure that you're in compliance with your state laws, because if they decide on a whim to check and see what you're running, and they see the black diesel, black oil in there, they're going to ask more questions. Now, if you're running it in something that never goes on the highway, then it doesn't matter. Road tax does not apply. So, hope that helps. Hope that gives everybody a little bit of an idea of what you can do running waste motor oil as a diesel fuel. And, before I forget, one more thing. Newer diesel engines do not like it. Don't run it in a Power Stroke. Don't run it in a Cummins 24 valve, a Duramax. Any of these, if your diesel engine has a computer and high pressure injectors, don't run it. You're going to void the warranty, and the high pressure injectors on these systems are a whole different ball game. They've got much, much, much higher fuel pressure injection, much closer tolerances, and they will not tolerate it. Waste motor oil is for older mechanical, direct and indirect injections on engines only, not the newer high pressure computer controlled ones. The cutoff on that for most vehicles, GM, you had the first cutoff to somewhat electronic control when the 6.5s came out with the electronic pump in 94, but you can really run them up into the Duramax. Ford, the cutoff is 94.5 when they went to the Power Stroke. And Dodge, I believe, went at 97 when they went to the 24 valve. Anything before those, you can experiment with these blends. Anything after those, people do it, but I do not advise it, because you're going to tear something up, and the parts then are much more expensive to get into and replace. So you're not really going to have any economic advantage to it. So, all right, now I'm really done. Hope that helps for everybody. Hope that helps everybody get an idea of what you can do with these and how you can reuse that waste motor oil to save a little money on your fuel bill if you've got the right kind of diesel vehicle. As always, if anybody has any other questions, you can catch me on email. Just go through my site at oldgrouch.com or catch us on our store's Facebook page at facebook.com/greatsurplusdeals. I'm always there, and just shoot me an email, and I'll help you out. Thanks a lot, and always, as always, Jack, thanks for the show.
Personally, on doing that, I know what he's saying there at the end about, you know, newer trucks don't do it. If I wanted to do this, I'd get an old, beat-up old truck, like an 80s model, or get a, you know, a Cuck V, a 1008, 1009, Mil-Serp. Those are great old trucks. I mean, they're a lot of fun to work on, and they're something unique, and they're not expensive. And, you know, we've talked about how to make sure you don't buy something you shouldn't when you buy Mil-Serp before. But those old motors like that, they can run this type of a mix all day long. In fact, I think in some instances, they actually, if you go with, you know, lower ratio mixes like 30%, they don't just do well, they do better and they last longer. That's my opinion after what I've seen over the years. Next up, I have another question for Doc Mullins. We have a 2-4 for Doc Mullins today. This one is on fish antibiotics. Doc recommends storing fish antibiotics in case you end up in a grid-down scenario and need antibiotics and can't get them. He has a pretty rigorous procedure for making sure you're getting ones that actually are the same as what you would get if they were prescribed for you. I won't explain it. I'll let him do it. But what if you're allergic to penicillin? What are the other options? Doc, take it away.
Hey, this is Joe Alton, MD, also known as Dr. Bones of doomandbloom.net, where you'll find more than 800 posts, videos, and podcasts on medical preparedness. I'm also the author, co-author, I'll say, with my lovely wife, Nurse Amy, of the brand spanking new 3rd edition 2016 of the Survival Medicine Handbook, just released, and also the timely Zika Virus Handbook. Consider checking them out at Amazon.com. I'm also the host of American Survival Radio on Genesis Communications and the Survival Medicine Hour podcast on Blog Talk Radio. This week's question for the expert counsel is from Autofab on Zello. He writes, is there an alternative to fishmox as an antibiotic to have in case of an allergy to amoxicillin? You mentioned that fishmox is exactly the same as amoxicillin as a way to keep antibiotics on hand. I have a penicillin allergy, so it's best I don't take amoxicillin, and I have recently been prescribed clindamycin and everything was successful. So this leads to my question, is there an over-the-counter alternative if there is a known possible allergy? Well, Autofab, there are a number of alternatives to fishmox, amoxicillin, that are still available without a prescription in aquarium and avian meds. As the first physician to openly write about the importance of having antibiotics handy for post-disaster settings, I've researched a number of these drugs and found them to meet my very strict criteria. One, they have to have only one ingredient, the antibiotic itself, nothing that makes your scales shiny or your fins or your feathers prettier. Two, they have to be only produced in human dosages, although they're supposedly meant for guppies and parakeets. Why does my guppy need an adult human's dose of amoxicillin? And they have to be identical to the antibiotic in form, color, and identification numbers. For example, Fishmox Forte is a red and pink capsule with the numbers and letters WC731 on it. Human amoxicillin is a red and pink capsule with the numbers and letters WC731. On it. In other words, exactly the same. Of course, many people like yourself are allergic to penicillin family drugs, but there are still options in fish and bird antibiotics that you can take. Doxycycline, also known as bird biotic, clindamycin, which you have taken, also known as fishcin, F-I-S-H-C-I-N, erythromycin, fishmycin, or metronidazole or flagyl, fishzole, ciprofloxacin, cipro, fishflox, and aquatic azithromycin, also known as a Z-Pak. Now, all of these drugs are acceptable to those allergic to penicillin and would, for Autofab and others with penicillin allergies, be useful for your medical storage. For information on how to use these drugs, check out our website at doomandbloom.net or get a copy of the 3rd edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. Eventually, these may one day be unavailable if the government gets its way, and it often does. So I suggest that you get some sooner than later. I don't think it's ethical for me to sell them, but they are widely available online, or you can find them at fishmoxfishflex.com. This is Joe Alton, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health and good times or bad. Thanks for listening. And oh, hey, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Prepper Show and on Facebook at Doom and Bloom. Thanks again.
Good stuff there. And I do want to point out Doc's comments about the end, get it before the government, you know, makes it not possible, is something that you really need to take seriously here. A lot of times people hear that and go, no, that's just marketing, in the words of Paul Wheaton. But in this case, the movement's already there. I recently heard a report that basically stated that the government is moving toward all antibiotics, or actually has already passed legislation that all antibiotics for animals like your pets or whatever now have to have a prescription from, you know, a veterinarian. And so the first thing I did was contact Joe about this, and I asked him, I said, is this going to affect the whole fish thing? And he said, no, this one isn't, but it basically is the last bit of the loophole. And with the way that the CDC, honestly, is shitting their pants justifiably about the overuse of antibiotics, it's quite probable that that loophole might be closed at some point in the future. So I'll just say that we have a good storage of this in our preps, and I would recommend that you maybe do the same thing. Next is a question for the Bee Whisperer, Michael Jordan, on dealing with varroa mites and your bees. Michael, take it away.
Hey, I'm Michael Jordan, the Bee Whisperer of a bee-friendly company out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, taking your questions on bumblebees to honeybees, apiary management and inspections, and mead making tips and recipes. This question comes from Charles in New Hampshire. Charles is a new keeper and wants tips on varroa mites. Here's what Charles asks. I recently installed a package of bees into a new hive and want to take preventative steps on controlling varroa mites in the colony this spring and summer. He has done some research on some solutions ranging from chemical strips, placing them in the hives, to smoking the hives with oleic acid. Not sure the best approach, and was hoping for some good advice. Well, Charles, I did a show on the Survival Podcast, episode 1747 on the Expert Council, on natural methods of beekeeping for pest control. It talks about things like using rhubarb leaves for oleic acid and how to use oleic acid for mite control. Now, I have personally never put chemical strips in my hive, but I've worked with some keepers that have. I'm not saying not to use them, but why use them when you can fog the hive with mineral oil or vapor oleic acid? This is oleic acid is like a world support. It has been used by beekeepers all over Europe and now in America, and it is super successful on all kinds of mite control all over the world. Chemical strips are for mobile hives that are on the road for pollination contracts, more than the backyard beekeeper. The backyard beekeeper is looking for a honey flow, and pollination contracts, they're not really looking for honey flow, they're looking for population growth and pollinization. So why waste the time and money on vapor on these types of chemical strips when I'm just going to tell you right now, vaporizing oleic acid can do it within one shot. With strips, you have to remove them from the hive before the honey flow in a certain amount of time, and with vaporization, it's a one-day blast. Right before brooding, and it'll go for a long time on your mite control. Now, there are a lot of non-chemical methods and controls. You can use screen bottom boards for mite checks, sanitation, which is called comb culling or biosecurity, drone boards for removal. Pretty big fan of that. Brood interruption, requeening and restanding stock, and the powdered sugar method. Now, your question is wanting to take preventative steps on controlling varroa mites. I would look heavily into oleic acid. Look at the vape system and how to use it. It's very cheap, very effective, and will prevent mites when done at a good time frame. Look how to use it and apply it just before jumping in. There's a lot of articles B-Source magazine, a lot of universities. They'll tell you all about it, the proper way, what to look for before installing the system, and how to do it at the beginning of the year and towards the end of the year. And then during the middle of the year, you need to just do mite checks. If you see a mite or two, I would slip in a green drone board into the hive. The bees will draw out a whole board of drone comb, and the mites love drones. The mites will jump right into them, and you'll be able to pull this drone comb out, and you can freeze it. You can scrape it into a fire pit. You can place it in your chicken coop, and they'll take care of your mite problem. But with the screen bottom board and putting on a grid check, you're going to find out exactly where the mites are. You're going to be able to slip in a drone board, collect the mites over a period of time, and then just remove them. And this is a natural way of getting the mites out of your hive. Like I talked about before, you can take the rhubarb, crush it up, and put the pulpous mix at the entranceway where the bees will crawl over it, and the oleic acid will remove the mites as they start to come in. And you can also take stinging nettle, make sure you wear gloves, roll it under a wine bottle, and stick it on the top of the hive, and this is a folic acid, which will suppress the mites down. So these are some ways of natural ways of doing it. I don't know what you're kind of looking for in preventative, but you can also see if the bees have mites, and I recommend two ways: the powdered sugar shake and the alcohol or soap wash. Both involve removing mites from the bodies of adult bees, then counting the mites to establish a standard of percentage of mites. And this is like the number of mites per 100 bees. You should look those up. And that way, if you think you have mites, you can kind of check to see the damage that you have per 100 percentile of bee accumulation. This will tell you that you have mites and that you'll be able to kill them. Like I said, just check them out. There's different control options and appropriate for each phase of the honeybee as well as the varroa mite season cycle. So you'll have to kind of start looking at the diversity of like the brood patterns of your bees and then the varroa mite seasonal cycle. I cannot tell you every method of control or even killing the mites. There are way too many. But I would start with a screen bottom board in the summer to see if you have mites. Hit them with oleic acid at the beginning of the year before brood making. And then every time you check your hives, dust them with powdered sugar before closing up the hives. This will help you on your mite control. You'll be able to start dusting the bees. If they have any mites, they'll clean them, they'll follow the bottom board, and you'll see them. And if you hit them at the early of the year, before the brood-making season, you can kind of get the oleic acid in there. And you can even use the mineral oil fogger and just kind of fog the heck out of those beehives with a good mineral oil. Heck, you can even drink good mineral oil. So those are methods that are a little more natural for to use. And I would see about those things before I'd start getting into some real chemical procedures and stuff, because anything with chemical, you know, you're going to get your bees on a vaccination cycle. And with anything like that, it's a chemical cycle that they're going to be fixed on and they're going to get used to, and they're not going to be a more natural bee. Try to downsize your bees so you can eliminate even tracheal mite, and that way the comb's smaller for the varroa mite not to get into. So those are some other methods to look into. I hope that this has kind of got you on a good check of using a screen board, dumping powdered sugar on the top of the bees every time you close them for a little bit of treat. And this will help you start removing mites and controlling them if you have them. Hey, I am the Bee Whisperer, Michael Jordan of a bee-friendly company, asking you to buy your honey from a beekeeper you totally respect. Buy it from a cottage industry, because we all had to start someplace, and help your fellow man. Especially the little ones, now more than ever, because they need mentors to get them on the path of love and life. Have a blessed day, everybody.
Good stuff from Mike Jordan. Last segment of the day, twofer from Stephen Harris. This one on testing your preps. I found this interesting, but I will save my comments for what I really found interesting about for after Steve is done. So, Steve, take it away on testing your preps before, not during a disaster.
Hi, this is Steve Harris calling in to answer your question. I had someone call, and they didn't call in, they emailed me, and they said that they got their battery bank done. Congratulations. And they did it in time for Tropical Storm Colin to move through Florida. Great, excellent. But they were disappointed because Tropical Storm Colin did not knock out their power, and they wanted to test their preparedness. Would you wait for someone to break into your house before it was the first time you ever shot your gun? Would you go skydiving without taking the class first and learning how to pull the ripcord and how to handle all the skydiving emergencies? No, you wouldn't. If you want to test your preps, you go pull the breakers to your house. And I'm going to tell you how to really make your preps very good by doing this in a moment. But I want to digress. Now, something I teach in my family preparedness class is I teach you how to store white flour, store rice, store beans, store corn, and I teach you how to prepare these real quickly and simply. This is the store it and forget it method of food storage. It is kind of like the old way of doing stuff. It's got advantages and it's got disadvantages. One of the best things I think I have ever heard Jack talk about is in one of the best things I think I heard him talk about was his method of doing food storage for people starting off. And Jack's method is you write down everything you eat in a notebook for 2 to 4 weeks. And you write it down the way he teaches you to write it down so you know how much you're eating. You can see it at a glance, and then you go buy extra and you store it on your shelf. You eat what you store what you eat. I think this is best illustrated by Jack in episode 1673. So I strongly recommend, if you haven't listened to this and you want to start in preparedness, listen to 1673. If you want more on Jack and food storage, listen to 1759 and 1613. So if you're a newbie to prep, you want to start, listen to those, and then go listen to any of my classes that interest you, because I got about 7 of them, at steven1234.com, and of course, everything from Jack and me is free. So if you really want to test your preps, what I want you to do is go and pull the breakers to your house and kill the power on like a Saturday morning or whatever day you pick. Then let's use Jack's method of using a notebook to get you prepared. So get a nice notebook, a nice big thick one. This notebook is only for your preparedness, nothing else. And get a nice pen and start to write down all of the things that you and the family discover are missing or you do not have after you pull the breakers. You have a natural gas or propane stove, but you need matches to light it when the power is out. Okay, so you're going to need some Bic lighters and some matches. You might want to vacuum seal a bunch of matches. Okay, you have an electric stove, and so you need a propane bottle stove or a Coleman stove to cook with. You put a thermometer in the refrigerator and freezer. How long for the fridge to get to 60 degrees Fahrenheit? How long for the freezer to get above 32 degrees Fahrenheit? Freezer will move up to 32 and will stay there for a long time. And then once it goes above 32, like the 35, things are beginning to melt. Do you have enough Panasonic and Loop AA and AAA batteries and lights for all your family that you can recharge and ease simply? Okay, you don't have enough 3-watt or 5-watt LED bulbs for all the rooms in your house, so you need some extra, and you need some extra extension cords. You can't reach all the rooms in your house. You need to store fuel for your car because you're running an inverter off your car, and the tank is near empty when you started this experiment, so you need to have extra fuel. I guarantee that you won't have your power off for more than a few hours the first day, the first time you do this, because you'll find so many things that you're missing that you found the point where you can turn the power back on. No point in doing this for a day or 2 days when you're missing a bunch of stuff. The idea is to do it right. So get the items that you're missing, play with them, Learn how to use them with the power on. And then go and pull the breakers again. And this time use the things that you were missing from the last time and see how long you can go now and write down all the things that you're missing again. Make my 30-second emergency bread from white flour. Listen to my free family class at Stephen1234.com. Get out some rice and beans and cook it with your emergency cooking method. Have the family eat dinner with your prep items, both what I teach and what Jack teaches, the old method and the new method. Let it go into the night. Try to power your refrigerator for an hour with an inverter from your car at idle. Yeah, this is from How to Power Your House from Your Car. And I have a refrigerator and freezer class that you can't miss at Stephen1234.com. I'm sure that you'll find lots of stuff that you're missing. So once you find the stuff that you're missing, turn the power back on and go get the items you're missing and practice again on another day and learn with them with the power on. And then the next weekend, pull the breakers again. And this time try to go overnight with the power off. This is how you test your preps. You do not wait for a blackout to test your preps. Like I said, would you wait for someone to break into your house before you shot your brand new gun for the first time? No, you're going to go to the range. You're going to practice. This is your class. This is what you teach yourself in preparedness. I can teach you all you like, but you are you. You have different things in a different place in the world than I am, and your situation is going to be unique from what I teach, so you're going to have to take what Jack and I teach, and you're going to have to teach yourself, people. Do this to test your food storage like I taught. Use it to test your food storage like Jack taught. Test with the power off from your battery bank. Test with the power coming from your house, from your car. Turn your water off. Test your backup sanitation. That's your lugabaloo, your 5-gallon toilet. And test your water storage. Do you have enough? Is it easy to get to? Can you pump it out easy? Is it in bottles? Do you need more? Test it. I read something really smart on Facebook a while back. Do you want to spend $3,000 on a gun, or do you want to spend $500 on a gun and $2,500 on ammunition and training? You want to spend $500 on a gun and $2,500 on ammunition and training. This will make you a much better prepared person. This is Steve Harris for the expert panel. Get all of my free stuff I have done with Jack. It's a treasure trove. It's free. You can listen to it with one click on your smartphone or your computer. It's at Stephen1234.com. This is Steve Harris for the expert panel. I'll talk to you guys again soon. Thank you.
What I found interesting about that was how similar Steve and I provide advice from that, with my advice coming from almost 8 years ago. In fact, 8 years ago today, I guess, because it was episode 3 of the Survival Podcast, where I called it the Survival Drill, and was basically turning off all the systems in your home, getting out a notebook, walking around and figuring out what you didn't have. Now, the difference is Steve is coming at this from the angle of, you're already prepared and you're going to test what you're prepared for. When I did that episode all the way back at the beginning, it was more about exposing you to how unprepared you were. So that would be about the only difference in it. And that's why you'll hear some differences in it. Like, instead of, well, you know, you're going to have this way to charge up your cell phone, your phone doesn't work. Once it's out of power, it's out of power. And, you know, if you have a way to charge your phone, then that's not the case. So when I was building this show in the beginning, I wasn't building it for the seasoned, experienced prepper. I was building it for the person that just finally went, holy shit, everything's not super. I need to make sure that I'm prepared. And then especially the people that did a little bit to get prepared and thought, well, I'm good. And then, well, maybe you're not as good as you think you are. So I think there's a lot of value to the concept of testing your preps. And it doesn't always have to be, you know, a day long or 2 day long or 3 day long thing. It can be a couple hours. And, you know, like I think I say this during my episode 3, which I'll have a link in the show notes to today. You know, pick a time of the year when it's a little bit more comfortable to do it. Don't do this to yourself the first time you ever do it on a hot August day with your air conditioner off and you're not ready to do something about your refrigerator and you're going to have your food go bad and whatever. Is learn to deal with the situations. And remember, you're the one that pulled the plug. You can put the plug back in. And all you need to know is, here's how I feel about testing your preps. Once you find four or five things that you've done really wrong, that drill has given you enough to work on to go back to the drawing board and get that stuff shorn up and then test your preps again. And I think that's, you know, that's why it doesn't have to be a multi-day thing. Now, I will say this. I think I sympathize a little bit with the person that asked the question. And I don't think it really meant maybe the way Steve took it, though it was a great teachable moment, and I'm glad he took it that way. But when we get storms, as long as the roof's not coming off my house, I got to tell you, I kind of like it when we have a power outage or something like that, because I get to use my stuff in a real-world scenario. It's not a drill. And, you know, there's none of this, well, I don't really think we should do it this weekend or something, because now it's here. And you could ask my wife if she'd ever come on the air. She'd tell you, I have a smile on my face, you know, a mile wide when I'm running cords from a generator, or I've got my truck backed up to the front door and I've got a cord running through and I've got the TV going and I'm watching the news to make sure that the storms are not going to hurt us, and I've got my phone out and I'm videoing the system. I think that it's an interesting thing that you go from being really pissed off or upset or, gee, I hope this comes back on before my freezer runs out, to kind of being a little bit excited about, okay, since I know this isn't serious, but I know this is real, and there's a realism to it that's not there in a drill, I actually kind of like it. I kind of anticipate the joy of being able to use the stuff, because it also kind of says, see, it works. That's the other thing that it does. Your family, your friends, they think you're over the top. You know, you call them and you go, what are you doing? Well, I'm sitting here in the dark. What are you doing? I was watching the news, but since I'm not too worried about the storms anymore, I'm watching a football game and drinking a cold beer. Right? I mean, there is a little bit of satisfaction in that, and I think that's a little bit more where the guy was coming from. Listen to episode 3. It is crappy audio. It is before I even had a good microphone, and the recorder was just laying in my lap, and I'm driving in the car. You can hear the road noise and everything. But it's so similar to what Steve just said, and we didn't even know each other's name at the time that I did that episode. I think I didn't meet Steve until like the 500s or something like that. With that wrapped up, I want to remind you, you can help support this show. If you love the work I do and all the great content that I bring you, just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. This is the time to do that because we are running a sale. The discount code is HEAT, H-E-A-T, H-E-A-T. That is the discount code. Remember that because it will get you a good discount. What is a good discount? 20% off, 30% off, 40% off? No. My friends, 50% off your first year of MSB, $25 for that $50 membership. I don't even want to say anything about the service discount because this is better. It expires Monday at midnight, Central Standard Time. And remember, I do not care if your dog ate your discount code. When I say a sale is going to end, it's going to end. So this weekend would be a great time to join the MSB. Use the discount code HEAT. Get 50% off your first year. Then immediately go to SafeCastle, get your free $49 membership, and you're profitable. And then call up Western Botanicals and get your $50 premium membership there and get 25% off some herbal supplements, and now you're double profitable. And then you still have discounts from over 60 vendors to use over the rest of the year. And do you think you're going to do okay with that? I think you will. That's why I built the program this way. The Member Support Brigade is win, win, win. You win because you get discounts. I win because I get your support. The vendors win because they get incremental business. That's what I try to do, is set up multi-win situations. That's what the MSB is. Please consider becoming a member today if you're not already. If you think our show's worth, 9 cents an episode, it is at a 50% discount. Why wouldn't you join it? If it's not worth a dime an episode, why do you listen? Just saying. Anyway, don't take that the wrong way, though. Some of you guys, you're paying off debt or whatever. I didn't mean it that way. It came out wrong. But seriously, I love your support when it's available. So thank you to all of you who have supported me over the years. Anyway, next up, remember, another great thing you can do is do business with other members of the TSP business community. All of the great entrepreneurs out there have started businesses either before or after being influenced by the Survival Podcast. And you can find out all about the directory by going to tspbiz.com, tspbiz.com. Just redirects you to the business directory on the main website. And our supporter of the day from TSP Business Directory is Small Barn Farms, listed in the farming homesteading category of the TSP Business Directory. They provide local raw honey to the Kansas City area, and they can also ship to your door. That is, again, smallbarnfarm.com. Check them out at the TSP Business Directory, and they will be in today's show notes. The other way you can support us, of course, is doing your Amazon shopping through our affiliate link. That's the easiest way to support us. It really is. And all you do is go to TSPAZ or TSPAZ.com, and you'll magically show up at Amazon. And you can just buy the stuff you were going to buy anyway. You spend the same amount of money. You type in one less letter. I mean, it is the easiest way to support us. Please consider doing that, because it doesn't really take anything out of your time or your pocket, and it helps us immensely. We've been doing very well with that program, and it's really something I kind of wish we did a long time ago. But I started doing the item of the day. And so that means every time you go to T-Spaz, you should see a different item, unless it's the same day and you've gone twice. And I also post the item of the day now on the blog, so you can find them all by clicking the tag in any of them. It'll bring up all the ones I've done so far, like four. But today's is an interesting one, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. And if you want to know more, you can go to T-Spaz and find out about it, or you can go to the blog and look at the post on it. But they're basically, it's just a five-pack of one-foot-long extension cords. Just that's all it is, five-pack, and it's $11. What the hell would you want with a one-foot-long extension cord? Well, you know how, like, underneath your desk where your computer is, and you've got maybe multiple computers and speakers and a subwoofer, and you got a router and a modem, and they all have these weird-shaped plugs? They can't just have a freaking normal plug? And then you get a power strip, and you, like, stick one big old honking thing for your subwoofer, for your speaker system down there, and it takes up, like, three or four freaking outlets? And then there's one left, and you have to daisy chain it to another like that. Or you have your UPS, and it's the same thing. You put the router plug in, and it just takes the whole space up, right? Okay, you get these one-foot extension cords. You plug the big honking thing into that, and a normal-sized plug into your power strip or your outlet or your UPS. I discovered these about, oh, I guess, 5-6 years ago at Fry's Electronics. They were just in a bin. And I went, oh, my God, I've been looking for this. This is the answer to my problem. So I found this five-pack on Amazon. I've ordered them for other things that I've set up, and they work fantastic. They're extension cord. I mean, you're not going to have a bad extension cord, really. But five of them for $11.50 or something like that, it will clean up the underside of your computer desk, the back of your TV set, etc. I think Stephen Harris would approve of this product, by the way. But if you don't want nothing to do with that, remember, if you're going to buy anything on Amazon this weekend, just go to T-Spaz, ignore my little cords, and order whatever you want, and you'll support our show. With that, let's talk about the ending song of the day. This is called The Battle of New Orleans by Johnny Horton. It's actually kind of a hokey song, and while there is some historical truth in it, it's not really, especially the part about taking an alligator and loading him up with powder to make him into a cannon, and then when they set the charge off, the gator loses his mind. That's not historically accurate. So why did I pick it? Well, I picked it for one reason, because it is about the Battle of New Orleans, and that was our featured history segment today. The other reason I picked it, I've wanted to play it for a long time, because when I was a kid, I loved the song. I remember hearing it for the first time, like on an oldies radio station or something like that, and I was like, that song's great, you know? And as I've said before, I was the kid that was going to join the military when I was, you know, when I still had single digits in my age. There's pictures of me with my grandfather dressed in a full camouflage when I'm like 9. And, you know, I've said before that if I had been around during the Vietnam conflict, I would have made what I think is a grave mistake today. I would have signed up and joined the military for that. Instead, I joined the military during the first Gulf War. In fact, Iraq invaded Kuwait on my 18th birthday. You can look it up, August 2nd, 1990. And I'm not ashamed of my military service, but I'm not as gung-ho about, you know, let's go off and kill other people, especially, you know, this is part of why I wanted the teachable moment for this song today. Even though I think it's kind of a fun song and whatever, it's really a tragic thing, isn't it? That all of those men that died, this one-sided victory, we tend to get really happy about our one-sided victories, right? So we lost 13, they lost over 700 men, and 50 imprisoned or something like that, and a bunch injured, 1,000 injured. And I'm sure we had injuries. And I'm sure that, you know, some of the men that weren't hurt, just being away from their families, etc., was hard and caused other problems. But all of those lives, including the lives of the, you know, the quote-unquote enemy, were lost, and the blood was shed for nothing. If the British had won that battle, the war was still over. If the British had lost the battle, which they did, the war was still over. And yet somehow we've glorified it. because we're number one in our heads. USA, number one. USA, number one. Like the stupid megachurch where they let the eagle go and they start chanting that, and the eagle like goes nuts and crashes because he's freaked out, you know? We need to check that in a lot of ways, you know, this day and age. How number one are we? What are we number one at? Well, we are number one at incarcerating people. We're number one at that. It doesn't give me any pleasure to say negative things about my country. There's a lot of people, you know, I'm an anarchist, and a lot of people in that space are happy to beat up on the country because they hate government. But see, I don't believe that the United States is government. I know it has the word states in it, but I don't believe that America is government. I believe it's us. I believe it's the people. And I believe it's an ideal. If you want to read something that sounds like an anarchist manifesto, instead of reading the Constitution, try reading the Declaration of Independence. We've been led to believe that those two documents are so similar, but they're actually dramatically different. The Declaration calls for us to take governments that are abusive of their people and cast them off. The Constitution gives the government the authority to resist them being casted off. But I think governments can be cast off without violence. It has to be incremental. It just happened. Britain just voted. We're leaving the EU. The EU is a lot like the United States was under the Articles of Confederation, a little bit more centralized than that, but nowhere near centralized we are with our Constitution, but yet it is precedent that a member of a union of states can decide, we don't want to do this anymore, and leave peaceably. That can happen. But, you know what? It's Friday. Let's just let it all go and listen to a song that, while it does commemorate a tragic event, it actually does it in a way that's, well, it has been well over, what, 200 years since that has happened? So it's been 201 years. I think we can be okay with it now. And I think we can enjoy a song. I think this was written in the 30s or the 60s or the 50s, something like that. But I love this as a kid, and there's not a lot of memories I have from that time that are really good memories. This is one of them. I want to share it with you. Hope you enjoy it. With that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. Help you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We looked down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales and didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Old Hickory said we could take them by surprise. If we didn't fire a musket, still we looked them in the eye. We held our fire till we see their faces well. Then we opened up our squirrel guns and really gave them well. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We fired our cannon till the barrel melted down. So we grabbed an alligator and we fought another round. We filled his head with cannonballs and powdered his behind. And when we touched the powder off, the gator lost his mind. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.